Hey everybody, today's episode is sponsored by Penzu, your personal journal in the cloud. Penzu is where millions of people keep their most private thoughts, all locked with a secret password. Go to penzu.com, that's spelled P-E-N-Z-U now, and sign up for a free account. For extra security and fun customizations, go to penzu.com/GoPro on your computer and use promo code Radical for $5 off your Pro or Pro Plus subscription. Once again, that's promo code Radical. Now let's get to the show.
This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode 27, and I'm really excited tonight because, or it's tonight here, because we actually have a visitor to The Radical Therapist studio, Palatial Studio, so Dr. Justine D'Arrigo-Patrick. Welcome, Justine.
Thank you for having me.
And for all our, we're just going right into the show, so on this episode. So for all our listeners who don't know Justine, I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. She earned her doctorate in marriage and family therapy from Loma Linda University in Southern California. Her dissertation research explored how relational therapists navigate postmodern and critical theories in clinical practice, specifically focusing on how therapists negotiate engaging in therapeutic activism in relation to issues of social justice while simultaneously embracing a postmodern therapeutic stance. Her clinical and research interests further include multicultural and diversity issues, post-oppositional, postmodern, and contemporary family therapy theories and teaching practices. While earning her doctorate, Justine has been an active member of the American Family Therapy Academy, AFTA, serving as a student committee chair and a student representative to the board, along with participation in various other academic communities or committees, I should say. So welcome to the show, Justine.
Thank you.
And I guess I should probably, for the sake of transparency, I should probably let all the listeners know that we've been friends for a while now.
So, yeah.
And actually writing partners. And we are actually going to be talking about your excellent article, which I'm generously a co-author on, titled Navigating Critical Theory and Postmodernism, Social Justice and Therapist Power in Family Therapy. And I thought this would be a very, well, we've been meaning to do this for a while, but it's finally happening. And I thought this would be, you know, we just had an election. I thought it would be an...
Did we?
Yeah, right, we did.
I thought I was dreaming.
Yes, quite a nightmare. Outside, I think, you know, we're a week away now. I think a week and a half away from the election. And in the United States, for those of that are listening in other countries. In our clinical communities, I guess, there's been kind of a wide range of reactions and effects. And a lot of my work, I think, as a supervisor has been attending to the people that I am supervising and the experiences that they're having and that their clients are having and that kind of thing. But I also have noticed there's kind of a move towards really wanting to respond in meaningful ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that includes advocacy and activism, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought it would be a great time to talk to you about your writing and your research and the work that you do as a way of kind of, because I do get a lot of emails from listeners about, well, how do you do this work and that kind of thing. And the thing I love about, I should say, I was kind of part of it, but the thing I love about your work is how you really wanted to go do that, to kind of see how people are kind of navigating the contours of critical work, activism, and therapy, but also, you know, how they adopt kind of the postmodern stance, which could have a wide range of things. But so I guess my first question for you, kind of with these recent developments, What do you think are the positives or negatives to this move towards activism and therapy? I know I'm hearing a lot more of it. I think a lot of our students are starting to want to be more active in the work. So what do you think?
Well, I think from one perspective, I think some of the positives of maybe more explicitly embracing this move towards activism and advocacy in our work is, I think, just to acknowledge that there's an intersection to the work that we do as therapists, that we don't, our therapy spaces and the clients that we work with, they don't somehow come into a room and then are isolated from the social issues going on around them in their lives. Yeah. And neither for us as therapists, that those are the same social issues that we walk with day in, day out in our lives as well. So I feel like there's a positive move here, because I think it's explicitly, I don't want to say forcing us, but maybe there's more of an explicit invitation that, hey, we got to look at this in our work. Mm-hmm. And especially in light of our recent election, I think that these are things that are kind of unfolding before us on a very national stage. Mm-hmm. And we can't say
a global stage, really.
And I don't think we can take the position anymore that these things are taboo topics to talk about in therapy. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to be in the crux of it. We need to be talking about these things, inviting these conversations, and I could probably say a lot about that. But I think that clients need us to take that step.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm gonna maybe go back in time before we get to your work presently.
Sure.
But how did you become interested in exploring how to navigate critically informed models or postmodern informed models in family therapy? When did that capture your interest, I guess?
Yeah. You know, I really got turned on to postmodern ideas, and just that the ways of thinking, the ways of being relational. I got turned on to those in my master's program from a woman named Dr. Tuttle.
Yeah.
I think we both.
Dr. Amy Tuttle.
That's right.
Yep. A mentor to us both, right?
Very much so, yeah. And continues to be. I think I just really appreciated the shift that postmodern theories brought to how we think in our field. And also some of the challenge that, I mean, I think I kind of inherently am a person that likes to challenge the status quo. And so I felt like postmodern theories really brought a different edge, mm-hmm. And also a different invitation for how we can be with people. Mm-hmm. And that's what really drew me to that, to wanting to delve deeper, explore who I was as a postmodern therapist. And critical theory, I grew up listening to Tracy Chapman, and so I think
it was punk rock for me. But
there you go, yeah.
And so,
but somehow, like just somehow, I think that there was something attuned in me to the very real impact of social issues. And I think growing up as a white kid, I think for a long time that was social class, and that really gave me the template for understanding other kinds of oppression. And so part of me really felt like that had to be a part of my work in some way. Mm. And so that's really what, and then as I started to learn about critical theory, it was like, hey, this is my jam.
Yeah, okay,
this stuff rings true. Yeah. I feel like this is important, and I think it's a responsibility for us to embrace. I don't know if we're getting to that question, but the guidance for how those two come together was a little bit elusive for me.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. We'll get there, but... kind of starting into the work, I guess for our audience, can you share a bit about how you conceptualize critically informed clinical practice? And then I'll probably ask you the same question about postmodern practice, but
perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think there's a lot of ways we can conceptualize it. I think there's a lot of ways people do conceptualize it. For me, critically informed practice is really about inviting conversations in the therapeutic space, and sometimes not even in the therapeutic space, but out in the communities where people live. But really trying to deconstruct some of those discourses that occupy so much space in our lives. And that really, I mean, and not just discourses, I mean, real social inequalities, policies, all of these things that really impact the livelihood of people.
Right.
And I think critically informed practice brings those into conversation. We don't just see a person as isolated from those things. Mm-hmm. And we don't just also try to make them adjust and and more adaptable to those circumstances. We try to shake it up. We try to undo it in some way. We try to empower and liberate. I don't know, liberate, put people's knuckles up and fight back. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now maybe can you say a little bit about how you conceptualize postmodern influence clinical practice?
Yeah. So postmodernism for me, and again, there's a big broad spectrum, right, of how people think about this.
For sure.
And lots of variation within the postmodern umbrella. But for me, I think the heart of postmodernism in therapy is leaving the door open to lots of ways of making sense, lots of ways of making meaning, inviting lots of ways of understanding one particular thing. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's not honing in too much on one particular idea, mm-hmm. and really pursuing a single thread, mm-hmm. but being comfortable that there's so many different ways to understand and to even like help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Okay. You stated in the writing, you stated that one of the questions that drove your research was the kind of impact that the activist stance may have on the therapeutic relationship and how it has not really been explored in the literature, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that idea, I think we've talked about it in the past. How do we know we're not decolonizing and the same hand recolonizing with something, you know, just
exactly.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's that term that we've heard too in some of the work we've done of that we're colonizing in a countercultural sort of way.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I don't think we know enough about what it means that what kind of effect taking an activist stance has. Mm. And I think I'm sensitized that too, particularly from my own social location.
Yeah.
So as a white therapist, you know, maybe I'm now letting go of the authority of structural theory, but now I'm taking on the authority of critical theory.
Right. Right.
And now I'm still the expert and I'm telling someone what's going on in their life.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what does that do to people
yeah.
when we take that position?
Yeah. What did you find out? I mean, how do you, I guess yeah. like really the question, we'll get there. Don't go there yet. But like, what did you imagine the effects might be or how were you thinking about it? Or was it more just, you wanted to kind of like, I wonder what's happening.
Yeah. So, I think that's still a territory for us
yeah.
to explore.
Yeah.
'Cause this initial research study, we didn't get there quite yet.
Yeah.
Initially it was trying to figure out how does someone actually embody a postmodern posture
yeah.
while also standing in the position of being an activist
yeah.
and telling clients or inviting clients to really see their situation through a social lens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some people would say, some people would say maybe that it can't be done, right?
Right.
but I think you and I both held the idea that there's probably some spaces in there that maybe it can happen. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that in our conversations that we learned is that people are doing this work.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily have the language or the articulation in our professional literature.
Very much.
Right. But they're definitely taking on and doing this work with right. clients. Yeah.
Okay. So, you also take the position early in the writing that with the exception of some narrative and relationally informed approaches, much of postmodern practice literature does not directly discuss how social power issues are attended to or what potential consequences may be of not being more explicitly attentive to them. And I guess I'm thinking sometimes, I think I read an article recently from Rhea Almeida.
Okay.
Where she was kind of challenging the postmodern stance and being critical of it. And, you know, she comes from a liberation kind of position. And oftentimes I talk to a lot of people that are very activist in their therapy and they make really good argument for me. Right. And so
right.
sometimes when I kind of step back into maybe this postmodern and we're seeing it kind of play out, I think, in the critique now of what happened after the election, right? But
yeah.
But I guess I'm wondering, you know, and postmodern practices sometimes get accused of the kind of doing nothing,
right?
So,
yeah.
But I think you found something differently, right? Or did you?
I mean, I want to say yes. Okay, right. Of course, I did. No, I mean, I definitely yes, and that's part of where this paper came from. Yeah. And that's part of what my interest is this critique about postmodern practice being kind of not taking a position, yeah. That somehow being open to multiple perspectives is a path out from having to be accountable to those social issues.
Right.
And I think it's the way people do it, though, is what can make it postmodern.
Hmm.
And that's what I found from people, that it's not that postmodern therapists don't value these ideas or don't value taking on these issues with yeah. their clients. But I think the way that, or I think the lack of language that's put to that in the literature is what leaves it open to this critique.
Okay.
Because they're not theorizing about how they take on power. They're not theorizing about how they bring in issues of race or class or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it talks about allowing the client to really have ownership of how the conversation unfolds.
Right.
And I think some of the critique in that, though, is that as a therapist, we're also co-constructing this conversation with a client, right?
Right.
And so the client isn't just bringing whatever they want to bring, they're also bringing what they feel maybe is okay to bring with us. And I don't think the postmodern literature does a really great job of talking about that.
Hmm.
And I guess when I'm saying postmodern literature, I'm talking maybe more about some of the relational collaborative kinds of perspectives.
Right, for sure, yeah.
And
I think you do discern that in the...
Yeah. But I think I'm not comfortable taking a position that postmodern therapists don't attend to power or to issues of social inequity.
Right.
There's just a different way of which they go about it.
Yeah, and we're going to get there too. So so this is really interesting. So you decided to go out and do some research and you had to find some participants. So how did you come to that? How did you find your participants?
Well, I mean, this particular research was kind of fairly theoretical in nature, right? And
sure.
So I had to make sure that we were talking with people that had the same language as we did around critical theory, postmodernism, and just from a lot from my reading, reading authors who are either doing clinical work or doing theoretical work around these ideas, I kind of targeted them and pursued conversation with them. And also I was able to talk with a lot of people because of my involvement with AFTA.
Mm-hmm.
That was a huge place where I was able to identify these people because I had heard them at conferences and things like that.
Right. So you were able to reach out pretty easily and grab some people. And
right.
And how did you go about talking to them? I guess maybe the question is what was your methodology?
Yeah. So, I took a qualitative approach because I wanted to really understand how they did it. So what their process was for integrating the two, we could call them epistemologies, we could call them paradigms. Grounded theory was the best suited for that. So that was the approach I took. And, I had some really, you know, open-ended interview questions and some really kind of directed sub questions to that. So really tried to steer the conversation around getting the essence of how do you do this work? How do you bring those together?
Mm.
And for some therapists really trying to help have them give me those examples, those clinical examples.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, and your findings, and we're going to go into kind of what you started to discover, because I think this is really great and fascinating, and I think, you know, provides a lot of, can really inform people moving forward, but we're going to move into your results, and I think it starts off, you describe finding what you're calling shared constructionist practices, in several of them, and I'm kind of curious, you know, what are these practices?
Yeah. So all the therapists that we talked to in this research identified ultimately what we defined as three really distinct ways that they tried to approach these issues, and we did term those shared constructionist practices, and those three were transparency, and basically that was about, you know, if I'm asking you a question about how race is at play, I'm going to be transparent with the client about why I'm asking that question.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
No, I'm not just going to, I'm going to reveal kind of what the map is in my head and how I'm understanding that.
Hmm.
The another one of them was inquiry as intervention. And so if at all possible, really trying to use questioning and inquiry as the method through which you shake up and disturb people's ideas and thoughts, get them thinking about it in a new way, versus telling them, hey, this is what's going on.
So yeah. In a lot of ways, you found that your participants did avoid psychoed, even from the critical side in some ways, or they were trying to do it more through questions or inquiry, or?
Yes, initially, yes. Okay. So that I would say that's like a preference from the beginning, right?
Okay, yeah.
And then in certain scenarios, depending on how people felt their ultimate like ethical responsibility was, that kind of took them down two different paths.
Okay.
And two for now. It's more complicated than that, but
sure,
yeah. Right. So the third shared constructionist practice that we identified and defined,
staying,
thank you. I'm like, help me out, Chris,
yeah.
Was staying experience near. Yeah. And so that really was just trying to be in terms of thinking about inquiry as intervention, really trying to have the question get to the heart of the experience the person is telling you about. Mm-hmm. Versus having the question come from a theoretical understanding about what it is they're describing. Mm. So, you know, how do I connect and ask a question that's like immediately informed by what someone is telling me about their experience versus, hey, I'm a therapist, I have all this knowledge. Mm. Let me use that to direct my question.
Sure.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. That's great. So you found, you described earlier, like they broke off into kind of these two directions. What are two directions? We know that's more complicated.
Right, right.
But there's these two directions. And I think you call one of them you start with therapeutic activism and you kind of describe how that happens. Can you say a little bit about that? Or
yeah.
Or the ways that you got a little more detailed about the ways they do it.
Right.
Yeah.
So we kind of, and again, you know, I take a constructionist approach to my research.
Sure.
So this is my creative interpretation, right?
Sure.
This is something I put together, but so it's not necessarily the way it is, but how we sort of understood what therapists were telling us is that all of them really are engaging in activism. All of them are taking on these larger social issues, oppressive discourses, whatever it may be. But what really like leads them is a difference in what they really feel like their ethical position is at the end of the day. And that we kind of thought took therapists down two different paths.
Yes.
And so therapists who really found themselves to be they were ultimately responsible to taking on some of these oppressive discourses issues. They engaged in what we sort of termed as activism through countering. There were the other group of therapists that we identified were people that really felt like at the end of the day, their ethical responsibility was to the relationship, the therapeutic relationship itself.
Hmm.
And we saw them as engaging in activism through collaborating. Okay. And so.
And can you say a little bit about how those two kind of modes look?
Yeah. Okay. So the first one, so those engaging in activism through countering, two primary strategies. One was social education and consciousness raising and being very intentional about that.
Okay. So that's where the education piece comes in.
And right? that's where the education piece comes in. And so sometimes that might mean being like exposing, that there's different gender socialization in our culture for males and females. And this is sometimes how we see them playing out. So being clear with clients about that, telling them that that's their perspective. We also saw that sometimes as therapists just having to name what clients are describing, like that's abusive or that's oppression or whatever it is.
Yeah. I had a supervisor once tell me that, there were some patriarchal practices at play in this particular case. And he really thought I should make those more explicitly visible because they were invisible to the particular person. And so this would be an example of
exactly.
That. Right. Okay.
Yes, exactly. So that was the social education consciousness raising part, teaching people how systemic racism works and how that impacts their lives, things like that.
Sure.
And then the privileging critical inquiry is, so this is related to as we're going along in the conversation, if clients don't really seem to be grabbing onto these ways of understanding problems or issues or challenges, the therapist, took the position that like they need to come back to that time and time again. They need to continue asking that line of questioning to hopefully bring that perspective more presently into the conversation. Mm. So if I'm asking about race and it doesn't seem to fit for the client, then I'm going to keep coming back to that. I'm going to ask about race again. If it still doesn't seem like
it's landing.
It's landing. Then I'm still gonna try to ask that in other ways. Hmm, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Then you move on to the kind of the more I'm drawing a blank.
Activism through collaborating.
Activism through collaborating. Yes.
Yeah. And this is where we see. And again, I would encourage anyone that's listening to this to just really read the article as well, because we tease this out a little bit more in the paper.
For sure.
And yeah.
And even though I'm one of the authors, I have to say it's a really great article.
So. Well, I thank you.
If you're looking for it, I'm going to do the plug really
sure,
quick.
Go
it's
for it.
Family Process. And once again, it's Navigating Critical Theory and Postmodernism, Social Justice and Therapist Power and Family Therapy, with the authors Justine D'Arrigo-Patrick, Chris Hoff, Carmen Knudsen-Martin, and Amy Tuttle.
So, yeah.
Just look it up. You'll find it.
Right. And so the way I'm speaking about this now, this is sort of like that trap of like, how do we talk about things in ways that doesn't further polarize or dichotomize?
Sure.
But activism through collaborating, really, we saw that as being evidenced by, you know, refraining or being cautious about social education. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, those therapists didn't want to be what we had spoken about earlier, colonizing in a countercultural sort of way,
right?
Telling people how they should be defining or understanding or being ascribe meaning to their problems,
to their experiences.
Exactly.
Right.
To their experiences. And so, we felt like leaving it open for the client to define that, those therapists seemed to think that that was activism. Allowing the clients to make their own meaning, even if it didn't fit the social lens.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other piece was really privileging client lead, which I think goes hand in hand with that.
Yeah.
So if we're asking a little bit about social class, and that doesn't seem to be a way someone is making meaning, and they take the conversation a different way, then we go there with them.
Mm.
And that relational respect, in a sense, is the activism piece. Because it's allowing people to be the defining say about how they're going to ascribe meaning.
Okay, so that's great. I just got an email this week I get asked these questions often about, you know, well, how do you, you know, make these ideas more real for therapists that are listening? And, you know, because I think sometimes they're in programs where it's very theory, lots of theory, not a lot of praxis, right? And so... maybe, and I think in your article, you do attend to clinical practice.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm wondering, you know, you suggest something about accounting for therapist power and then maybe some tips for enacting therapeutic activism. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So going back to those shared constructionist practices, we really felt like those were the three primary avenues that therapists use to be accountable to their power.
Sure.
And some of the suggestions that we make about that, or kind of like, so what is transparency? So what is inquiry as intervention? We give some examples of what that is. And for transparency, really, like I said before, is telling clients what informs your line of questioning and your curiosity.
Which really counters kind of some dominant ideas about, you know, therapist transparency, really.
Like, of course,
you know, yeah. we're introduced to the blank slate idea,
right?
And this is really much different than that,
right? Yeah, and that's, you know, how do we even out the imbalance of power, even though we can't reduce it completely?
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. And I think also that transparency piece is being taking the ownership for why you're interested in that. So situating your interest in that in your own personal experience, and letting clients know that. Some other things. So like for inquiry as intervention, this is similar. Like we talked about before, where you're asking about the effects of social issues rather than telling people about the social effects of issues.
Mm.
And that's also really different, right?
Yeah, very different.
we're very socialized in our professional, in lots of professional spaces.
Yeah.
To be the ones with the expert knowledge, yeah. Telling people how things are working.
Yeah. Interpret their experience for them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so this is really saying, you know, maybe a way to account for our power is to refrain from doing that.
Yeah.
And engage differently.
That's great.
Yeah. And the last one for that was staying experience near with clients and having your questions be really connected to that. So trying to, as you're asking questions, really trying to connect to that emotional experience of the client.
Hmm.
and not getting too heady, right? Like, I know for me, that's always a challenge.
Yeah, right.
I always want to go theoretical. I always want to go philosophical. But how do we stay engaged? Yeah. How do we stay engaged in that emotion, you know?
Right.
Because that's where I think the transformative power is when we connect at that level.
Awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And did you ask about enacting activism as well?
Yeah. And maybe more on the postmodern activism through collaborating.
So activism through collaborating and how we see therapists really embodying that and practicing that in their work is really being intentional about placing their clients above critical ideas. Mm. Not letting the critical ideas take over the person that you're sitting with, right? Mm-hmm. Not losing sight of them. And some of these things sound really basic, but I think they're things that we oftentimes can lose sight of pretty easily.
Sure.
And another one of those is being tentative when bringing social issues into the therapeutic conversation. Yeah.
Hold them very tentatively.
Hold them very tentatively. Yeah. And I think sometimes we come in with ideas that just pummel.
We're absolutely sure this is what this is.
Exactly, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then also another part.
As a matter of fact, I'll share an experience. I had a couple, a black male, heterosexual couple, black male client, white female. And there was a problem with the father-in-law. And I kept trying to enter in the idea of race because I felt like it was my responsibility to kind of bring that forward.
Yeah.
And over again, he would say, no, it's not that. No, it's not that. And yeah. I thought for sure it was, but it didn't land at all with him. And so I felt like I was almost stuck at one point. So
yeah. And I think that goes right into this next piece of like being willing to move away from those critical threads if that's not where the client is telling you they are. Yeah. And yeah. I think we can be really seduced into this space of trying to make someone see something, right?
Yeah. And I think I was getting caught up in that particular situation.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think we bring those ideas and those conversations to the table because we want to empower people. We want to liberate people from some of these oppressive things. Yeah. But then it's a really interesting space we get into because when they're not making meaning the way we're making meaning, then now we're putting them in more of a powerless position by forcing our ideas. Mm. And so that's not liberation. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think there's going to be any critique or pushback on some of these ideas?
I hope.
Right.
Right. Doesn't that's a...
That's a good sign.
I think you and I have talked about that. That's a good sign, right? Yeah, right. It means we're disturbing a little something.
Yeah, right. And I guess if you do have some feedback for us, please contact us. And we would be happy to hear from you if you read this article and have a lot to say. Because I know we do run in circles with some people that are very kind of in the activist place.
Yeah.
And some of this article is maybe asking people or kind of identifying those places, but also identifying other places that might seem problematic with a lot that's going on today, right?
Right.
About letting clients take the lead and maybe being willing to let things go a little bit, right?
Right. And I think, again, there's so much nuance. There's so much complexity.
Sure.
And I'm definitely not trying to position one way like over the other or to pit them against each other.
Right.
But I think that, and again, I can acknowledge that maybe this is coming from my own experience as a white person living in this world, but I want to say that there's multiple ways to engage in activism.
Yeah.
And I think that the discourse has been maybe a bit more narrow about that in our literature.
Yeah. Great point. Yeah. Okay. So I think finally, you are an educator. I forgot to probably mention that you're currently a professor at Cal State San Bernardino.
Yeah.
With John Lindsley and Lorraine Headke, two of my favorite people. And
becoming two of mine as well.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so you do a lot of training and it's supervision at some level, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering how are these ideas now informing you as a trainer or a supervisor, and how does it have you thinking about that kind of work?
Yeah. So I think initially, like right now, what it really has me thinking a lot about as an educator and a trainer is helping students navigate through what it means to create or cultivate an ethical stance as a therapist. Mm. And when I talk about that, I mean how to use power. We talk about how to account for power. We talk about how to try to minimize therapist power. But the fact is we still have power.
Right.
And in my own experience as a student and now even on the other side, I don't think we have a lot of conversations about helping people think through how to use the power they do have.
Right.
And that's the biggest piece for me, I think, in working with students and those who are going to be counselors and therapists in the future, is you have power, and how are ways that you're willing to use it and not willing to use it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful. I mean, is there anything else you want to say that I didn't ask you? That
I'm excited that we were able to work on this paper together.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm excited about some of the work we have in the pipe.
Yes.
And I think that this is, I think particularly now with where we're at as a country, and also, yeah, like you say, globally, yeah, these questions are ripe for further exploration. I mean, I think that in the days ahead, we can't not take some of this on in our work.
For sure.
Yeah. None of us are untouched.
Yeah.
We're touched in different ways, right, but none of us are untouched. And so hopefully I'll be on this podcast again in the future talking about what kind of effect an activist stance has and more of what that's like. Yeah,
for sure. Before I let you go, though, how can people find you? Where would they find you if they want to reach out to you and get in contact with you?
Yeah, so you can find me on the Cal State San Bernardino website.
Yeah.
I have a pretty simple email address that anyone's welcome to email me at. You probably can't spell it, but it's just justine.dorigopatrick@csusb.edu.
And I will link that on the show notes, everybody. So you can contact her if you would like. So
wonderful. Okay. Yeah, would love it.
Okay. All right. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Chris.
You for actually, you're my first visitor in the Palatial Radical Therapist Studios.
I love it. You've got a good gig set up here.
All right. So usually I'm doing these things through Skype, so it's really nice to be sitting across the table from you and having this conversation.
Likewise,
and,
definitely.
It reminds me of the days when we were talking about these ideas, like over coffee at Stell's over there by Loma Linda University.
That's right.
And kind of hammering all this stuff out. So
that's right.
It's nice to be able to have this thing published and be able to sit with you and have a conversation about it. So
definitely.
Yeah. Thanks for coming out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justine.
Yeah.
Well, that's our show. And as always, thank you for listening. I want to thank again Dr. Dorigo Patrick for coming on the show. She is going to be a force to be reckoned with. So keep an eye out for Justine's work. It's going to be, I just think it's going to have a large impact on the field. So, and I am biased, just so you know. Once again, the article that we were talking about that guided our conversation can be found in the journal Family Process, and it's titled Navigating Critical Theory and Postmodernism, Social Justice and Therapist Power in Family Therapy. And the authors are Justine Dorigo Patrick, Chris Hoff, that's me, Dr. Carmen Knutson-Martin from Lewis and Clark College, and Dr. Amy Tuttle from Pepperdine University. And I think you'll find it very a worthwhile read. So anyway, as always, you can find The Radical Therapist on various social media outlets, including Instagram at The Radical Therapist, Twitter at The Rad Therapist. We're on Facebook. Go like the Facebook page, please, The Radical Therapist. And as always, you can email me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. I still have stickers and would be happy to send them out to you. Just shoot me an email and ask, or even shoot me an email and I love being in conversation with listeners. So, as always, thanks for listening. My name is Chris Hoff, and this has been The Radical Therapist.